All right. Okay. Well, hey, maybe it's time to get started here. So first, I'd like to welcome you again to the this EW seminar. I should mention that actually the seminar I'm going to give here, on the one hand, is based on the talk that I gave at the FOCAPO meeting early in January, and I know that obviously a number of people, especially from companies, were not able to attend, and also students here. So I thought, in that sense, it might be instructive. The other thing that happened is that the CAS division has actually asked me to give a webinar this Thursday at 2 o'clock. And I thought, well, because of the time difference, that would also not be convenient, especially to, those companies overseas. So that's been the motivation. So I think the way to view this talk, in a way, it's a more sort of a summary type of talk in terms of, what has been accomplished in the area and what are some of the remaining challenges. I think in terms of, I think it's not moving. Can you try? So one of the motivations for looking at the area here of enterprise-wide optimization, it's still not... Okay. So obviously, the size of the chemical industry and its economic impact, we're quoting here figures in terms of the U.S. And, of course, one of the driving forces here is of the stronger international competition, although, for example, one of the interesting developments lately with the shale gas that will, in fact, also help a lot in the competitiveness of the industry here in the U.S. Nevertheless, there's been, obviously, pressure for reducing cost inventories, reducing the ecological footprint. It's not moving. This is terrible. I'm sorry, we're having some problems here. This is a Macintosh, by the way, so if I weren't embarrassed. Okay, all right. So the major goal then here is, of course, to perform enterprise-wide optimization. And I should mention that in terms of the actual term enterprise-wide optimization, the first time I heard about it was at ExxonMobil. This was in the early 2000s. In fact, that's part of the FOCAPO 2003 meeting. And I would say there's sort of two papers that sort of introduce a concept. I wrote a perspectives article in 2005. And then 2 years later, the group at Purdue wrote also an article on the topic, although that was geared more towards the pharmaceutical industry. And again, what we want to address here are the challenges that arise in terms of optimization, in particular for modeling and solution methods. So what do we mean by enterprise-wide optimization? Well, I think obviously the group here is more than familiar, but just to remind you, we're looking at here at the activities that can start upstream, like R&D, going through material supply, manufacturing, and distribution, and having in mind multiple objective functions that include economics, inventories, reducing ecological footprint, or maximizing, for example, responsiveness. And the key element, obviously, in enterprise-wide optimization is always the corresponding supply chain. And here, as an example, the one I'm presenting is the one that arises in the petroleum industry, where you have a very long and complex supply chain, starting from the level of wellhead, where you extract the oil, you do the training, transfer the crude, the heart is, of course, the refinery processing, where we separate into products, and one of them being gasoline is then transferred ultimately to the gas station level through the pump. And obviously, the idea here, or the vision, is can we optimize this very large system, because, of course, realizing even if it's only relatively few percentage savings, is going to translate into very large amounts of money. Again, okay. So the key issues that arise in this problem are, number one, the fact that we're dealing with a problem that is at multiple timescales. So we're dealing with planning problems that are looking at the longer terms, months, years, dominated by economics. Intermediate term, which is sort of the scheduling type of problem, days, weeks, driven by feasibility and down to the control level. And one of the issues that arises in this problem is, of course, the fact that we're also dealing with multiple levels. Typically, at the planning levels, these are more simplified LP, MLP type of models. Then we have an intermediate level scheduling, usually mixed integer and control. These could be RTO, MPC type of models. So how we integrate these models is, of course, a big challenge. The other challenge is the question on how we integrate information systems with these modeling and solution methods. The idea here being that if we have the as a basic layer, the what we might call the transactional IT, here's sort of the heart is the ERP system, your Oracle, the SAP system, and so forth, gathering information. Now, usually these systems have rules that translate information into material requirements, distribution requirements, using sort of largely heuristic rules. And the idea then here is to have essentially these type of analytical models that help to support the layer of transactional IT. So, for example, we have longer-term strategic type of models that are coupled with medium-term tactical, and then the production and scheduling on the left, and then on the right, sort of the logistic type of model. So the idea or the vision here is to, again, exploit the power of the ERP systems that are collecting that information and interface them with the optimization models. Now, in order to for that to happen, obviously the framework that we're using here is based on mathematical programming, and in particular, in its more general form, that takes the form of a mixed integer nonlinear programming problem, where, as you can see, we have continuous variables x, the discrete variables that are normally 0, 1, don't have to be, but that's a more common case. And, of course, the general form of the model is with the equations, the equality constraints, and inequality constraints. The equality constraints is usually the bulk of the model, and then, in this case, we assume a single objective function to start with. Now, of course, if we look at the particular cases of this MINLP, so in the case of continuous optimization, where we have no discrete variables, and of course, if we look at the linear case, there's very powerful linear programming codes that have been developed, like CPLEX, Express, Kurobi, and so forth. And it's these type of codes that, for example, especially if you think also the fact that theoretically you could solve these problems in polynomial time, like within the Interpoint method, have promoted, especially the application to extremely large scale problems. The nonlinear counterpart has also seen important progress over the last decade or so, with a number of codes gone up, and then, of course, here at Carnegie Mellon, happy up with Larry Beagler's and a number of other codes, including some codes that do, in fact, do global optimization. Now, here, nonlinear programming has, of course, also found applications, especially in real-time optimization and increasingly large-scale models. But in terms of issues, there's still the question of, the convergence of these models, because these are, after all, based on Newton's methods, and then, of course, also the issue of non-convexities, which means that we may trap into local solutions. Now, in the mixed integer case, we have both the MILP and MINLP. For the linear case, this is essentially an extension of the LP codes, the same ones as I mentioned before. And I think in the area of EWO, there's been a lot of applications of mixed integer linear programming, especially for planning and scheduling. And I'm just citing here some of the review articles or the book by Pochet and Woolsey that extensively make use of that. In MINLP, there's also been an important change in the sense that maybe, say, 15 years ago or so, DICOP was virtually the only computer code that was available. These days, there's a much larger number of codes available, like the Alpha ECP, SPP, the branch and bound, and GAMS. And here, in a similar way, there's also for Global, Baron, and Quinn that, for example, can handle these problems. Now, the issue here is, again, these codes are leveraged, obviously, progress that has been made in MILP and NLP. But again, in terms of issues, their application is not totally trivial, because aside from issues related to convergence and non-convexity, when you have the discrete variables, these problems, of course, are NP-hard, so there is the issue of scalability. Now, however, one aspect that has, one component that has had a huge impact in order to be able to make the application of these tools possible, a modeling system. So here, just giving us an example, modeling systems like GAMS, AMPL, and AIMS that are essentially algebraic modeling systems where, for example, with indexing capability, we can readily formulate large-scale problems, or, for example, capabilities of automatic differentiation and interface with the solvers have greatly facilitated the development of these models. Because one of the things, especially for EWO, the models do tend to be, if you wish, more simplified in nature, so that's a natural way of deploying these type of capabilities. And that's, so in that sense, I would say these systems have had a really big impact to make math programming possible, in, at least in practice. Now, one other framework that we can use in terms of math programming is what we've termed here generalized disjunctive programming. And the vision here is to combine logic with equations. So, for example, as you can see here, instead of having 0, 1 variables, we have Boolean variables. And why is that? Well, because we can specify, for example, logic propositions in symbolic form, or we can express the logic of the continuous space through the use of disjunctions. And the whole motivation here has been, you know, again, to facilitate the modeling. And right now, the availability of codes for these type of problems is still, you know, somewhat limited. We started with LogMIP, and currently GAMS is expanded through EMP, the application of these techniques. But I just bring it to your attention because, of course, in addition to GDP, there's other logic-based type of approaches, and in particular, constraint programming that have been used, especially for scheduling type of problems. So codes like the iLog CP, CHIP, and Eclipse are examples of that, you know, kind of capability. So there is plenty of of tools available. Now, all the models that I've talked about here are for deterministic models. So obviously, one problem that is always of great interest is the one of uncertainty, how we handle uncertainty. And perhaps the most general way to do that is stochastic programming, and in particular what is called multi-stage stochastic programming, where we have, for example, a sequence of stages where we make a decision, for example, X1, and then optimize the expectation over decision X2 and stage 2, and so forth. And I think maybe the easier way to visualize that problem is a special case of the two-stage programming, where here at stage 1, for example, we make a decision that may apply, let's say, for the next week or so, and then the uncertainty is revealed, let's say, for example, the demand, and then we take recourse action in stage 2, which would be maybe after a month. Now, here the more common case is the so-called case of exogenous uncertainty. So these are uncertainties that are essentially realized independently of our decisions. And again, a good example could be the demand of a product. No matter whether, say, we build or not a given plant, in principle, that uncertainty may be there. There is, however, other type of uncertainties, and that's the ones that I've listed here, planning with endogenous uncertainty. So these are things like yield sizes, the outcome of testing of a given drug, where the uncertainties will be a function of the decisions that we make. Okay, and I'll present an example towards the end of the talk, but I just bring this up here because the main issue when you deal with uncertainty, the problem is not well defined to begin with. So in other words, we cannot just simply say this is the optimization problem of uncertainty. We have to characterize uncertainty. But furthermore, even the objective, and just to make that point, you may have heard the term robust optimization. So robust optimization, in contrast to stochastic programming, is dealing largely with feasibility over an uncertainty set. And I'm giving here just a very simple example of a linear programming problem where we minimize the linear objective, C transpose X, and we have a set of linear inequalities. But here, the idea is that the coefficients A, all right, are described into an uncertainty set given by an ellipsoid. And the purpose of solving this problem is to make sure that we meet the constraints for all possible values, in this case, of U, that define this coefficient A. So again, it's largely feasibility that is the main issue here. And so here, for example, in the case of EWO, this has been applied especially to problems related to robust scheduling, giving here some papers by Lee Flores and Lee Yorapetritu that sort of talk about this type of application. Now, I mentioned before the math programming framework, a single objective, but in fact, especially in some of these EW projects, often we'll have to deal not with one, but with multiple objective functions, and we'll see an example at the end where we may have, for example, economics as one objective, responsiveness being the other one, or we could be, again, minimizing environmental impact. And here, the main issue about these type of problems is that you have essentially a set of Pareto optimal solutions. So here I'm plotting F1 versus F2, and the main concept here is that in general there's not a unique solution to this problem, but a whole set of infinite set of solutions, as some of you might be familiar. The idea being here that if I want to reduce F1, I can do that only at the expense of increasing F2, or the contrary, if I want to decrease F2, I can do that only if I increase F1. So these are so-called trade-off solutions. The main point here is that in terms of solution methods, a very common one is the so-called epsilon constraint, where you place one objective as a constraint with a value of epsilon that you keep varying in order to generate a number of points in the Pareto surface. The more general way is to use what is called parametric programming, especially, you know, based on the work of Stratos Pisicopoulos, and that works especially well for linear problems. In the case of nonlinear, this is somewhat more involved. Now, we deal also, of course, with large-scale problems. So one of the issues here, it's not simply a question of formulating a model, but we may have to deal with problems that, due to its size, we may want to exploit the structure. And here, of course, one of the perhaps most common techniques is Lagrangian decomposition. Here, the basic idea is that we have problems with so-called complicating constraints. As you can see down here, we're assuming a problem where, let's say, I maximize a given objective, subject to a set of constraints over n time periods, for example, or n scenarios, di, xi equals di. And the idea here is that if I had only those constraints, the problem would decouple into the n sub-problems. But I also have this set of complicating constraints, ax equals b, where that matrix A will involve variables in x1, x2, and x3 in this case. And that's what's essentially preventing us from doing or decomposing the problem. So here, the basic idea in Lagrangian decomposition is you dualize that constraint, and then you iterate between, you know, the problem, the decomposed problem, where you fix the multipliers, and then the problem where you actually do the primal problem. The other way of, and again, so this technique, you'll see, has been widely used in EW projects, problems. The other major type of approach is Bender's decomposition. Here, in contrast to complicating constraints, we have complicating variables. So here you can see in the matrix you have the variables y, and the idea here is that if you fix y, the problem decomposes again into subproblems for x1, x2, and x3, and that's shown here in the set of constraints, say y plus zi, xi equals zi. And the idea here in Bender's decomposition is that by fixing the variables y, we solve the subproblems, and then we somehow recover dual information in order to update the new cases for the variable y. This is sort of in very simple terms. Now, this type of technique, Bender's decomposition, especially extensively used in two-stage stochastic programming, the so-called L-shaped method, is really nothing else but Bender's decomposition. But there's also a variant to that, and that's a decomposition that we have termed bi-level decomposition. It was actually developed with my former student, Ayer. And the idea here is still very much the same type of decomposition as you would do in Bender's, except the difference here is that the master problem is not defined through dualities as usually done in Bender's, but rather the master problem here is some type of aggregate problem that is especially in some reduced space. So this is, that's why we call this a tailor-made type of decomposition, because you, the user, have to specify what that master problem is going to be. But the idea then here is, say, if I'm maximizing, again here I'm obtaining an upper bound, and I get some variables that I can then fix, and then I do the subproblems, with the fixed complicating variables, that gives me a lower bound, and then you iterate until the bounds converge. And every time you go back to new iteration, you add some new cuts in order to, if you wish, refine the or strengthen the representation of that master problem. Yeah. So these are some of the decomposition techniques, and a lot of the work that we've done here in the context of the EWL project of CAPD has been sort of in the spirit of a multidisciplinary type of environment, where in addition to people like Larry and me and Kemi, and now more recently, of course, Nick will also join this effort, we've had people from OR here in Carnegie Mellon, Nick Socomandi, John Hooker, and then at Lehigh, also a number of people. Most recent one is Katja Scheinberg, before Larry Snyder, and Jeff Lindroth. And over the years, it's now, I think, about 6 years almost that we've started this project. And what is interesting here, and we wanted to reflect, well, what has been accomplished, what are some of the things that we have learned. And here, I'm not going to read you, of course, all the projects, but I'm just listing here some of the major projects that we've had, over the years. And again, you can see they range from supply chain type of problems, distribution, problems related to gas pipelines, problems related to multi-site planning and scheduling, batch scheduling, problems related to global optimization, and so forth. So there's been a lot of variety, and the question has been here, what have we learned, if you wish, from all these projects. So I would say some of the major issues that we have observed in doing these projects are the following. So first, this decision of linear versus non-linear, okay, and we'll see how that has been evolving. Then another big issue has always been the multi-scale, again, because of the scope and all of the problems we're dealing with here. There's always been sort of a great interest to introduce uncertainty, but how you do that is still, I would say, a major challenge. Then another one is the fact that often, for example, especially if you look at some more strategic type of problems, these that tend to be dominated by economics, but you also often are interested in performance. So here, how do we handle these type of multi-objective type of problems? And I would say invariably, in all cases, computational efficiency in large-scale problems has always been a problem. For the simpler cases, it is possible maybe to develop a model, turn it over to the solver, and we're pretty much done with it. But very often, we do have to worry about, how to solve these problems using some special purpose type of algorithm. And the last point I wanted to mention here is this question of commercial versus off-the-shelf software. I'm just going to take care of this because here I think clearly what we have learned is that while obviously there is some commercial software out there, it's still fairly limited in the sense that often in applications you have a particular feature, a particular aspect that cannot be readily accommodated, for example, in some of that commercial software. And given the fact that, again, these days we have modeling systems available and so forth, by and large, it seems that I'm not claiming in all, but certainly in a very large number of cases, you're just better off having your own system tailored to your applications. I think, of course, many managers would like to think that you can, say, take SAP and use the APO and use APO for solving all kinds of problems. That's simply not going to happen. That's the first thing. And even if you can do it in some cases, again, sometimes it's just simply not worth the effort. But let me address some of the other issues first. The linear and non-linear. So why the emphasis on linear? Well, I would say a very good part of enterprise-wide optimization has been driven by scheduling problems, in particular scheduling, batch scheduling. And here, this area has been totally dominated, say, over the last decade by mixed-integer linear programming. Now, the problem in batch scheduling, again, just to give you a little bit of an insight, it's a problem where to begin with the modeling part is not trivial because you have to make decisions. Do we do discrete time representation like a fine grid here or various type of continuous time representations or how you represent the events with global times, with time slots, with precedence type of constraints? And then, of course, there's also the issue of topologies. Multi-stage has been sort of the more prevalent, but then the more general is the network type of structure, like in the STN or RTN. And another interesting phenomenon here has been the choice of objective functions. So it turns out objectives that are economic in nature may give rise to models that are much easier to solve than when you use, for example, makespan, which is the completion center. And I think about this area, I cannot obviously make justice to it in a single slide, but I thought it would be important to note that this is an area that actually emerged in the late 70s, first from Switzerland. David Rippin, and here in the U.S., Rex Ricardis were sort of, in many ways, sort of the pioneers who studied this area. And this area has actually become, in many ways, also, rather mature in the sense that, for example, if you look at the work of the State Pass Network, the work of Condilli, Pantelidis, and Sargent, has provided a fairly general framework for addressing these problems. Doesn't mean the problem is solved. And here you can see, by the way, that paper is one of the most cited papers in the PSE areas. And that's interesting because in the late 70s, early 80s, at least in the chemical industry, scheduling was virtually, not considered at all, at least as part of sort of what a chemical engineer or even in process systems engineering one would do. There's been, over the years, of course, a number of reviews in the area. And again, just to show that this area continues to develop new ideas, this is an example of a work by Christos Maravelias, where there's been ideas of further unification and generalization. So the main point here is this continues to be an active area of research. Now, but again, a lot of that has really drawn on mixed integer linear programming. And just to give you an idea why often there is, of course, this big temptation to do that, this is recently a problem that was supplied to me by Maria Ruiz. This was related to a supply chain problem, actually, for ABB. And you can see it's a fairly large problem, 2,001 variables, almost 40,000 constraints, 80,000 constraints, 40,000 variables. What sort of blew my mind is when I received that answer, I said, well, but let's see how that looks like. And you solve the problem, in this case with CPLEX 12.2. You obtain the solution with a gap of less than 0.5%. But to me, what was really amazing was to think we could solve the problem in less than 27 seconds. I mean, this is something that was absolutely unthinkable, let's say, maybe 10 years ago. There was absolutely no way you could think of a problem this size you could solve this fast. Now, this does not mean, of course, that we can solve every problem of this size in less than 30 seconds, but it just simply means that with proper formulation and so forth, we may, you were starting to reach a stage where, again, solving large-scale industrial problems is feasible. Now, on the other hand, of course, there is the issue that, nonlinear models may still be required because we have process models, okay? And furthermore, MINLP, for example, and when you do things like cyclic scheduling, stochastic inventory, or mixed integer dynamic optimization, you still have to do that. So the problem, but the dilemma here is we cannot just simply live exclusively with MILP models. We do have to also accommodate the nonlinear world. And a good example of that is this project that we have done with BP, dealing with nonlinear models in refinery planning. What we're showing in this figure is sort of a typical configuration of a refinery. And usually this type of problem, refinery planning, is done these days in industry with a package called PIMS, basically LP-based type of models. Okay, and the idea here has been that in these linear planning models, the simplest model is a so-called fixed yield, where what you do, you have this the distribution of percentage volume, the TVP curve that tells you roughly, ahead of time what percentage you produce of the different products like fuel gas, naphtha, light distillate, and so forth. There's been a further refinement with, for example, the so-called swing cut model, where you allow between the boundaries some slack, so at least in that sense you're trying to capture, if you wish, to some extent, nonlinearities that may arise. But this is not done explicitly. So here, what we've done, this work with Abdul Alatas, is to consider a nonlinear fractionation index model. It has an attractive feature that it is crude independent. It avoids, again, more complex trade-by-trade type of models. In a way, you have to think there's still as being some type of shortcut type of model. But it has a nice feature that, for example, you can generate cut-point temperatures. And just to give you an example of that type of model, this is a case where we have four crudes going, from lightest to heaviest, as is shown in the table here. And what we wanted to do here was to ask the question, is it really worth the effort to go to a nonlinear model? How much are we going to gain versus a linear one? And here, as you can see in the table, the fractionation index for three different cases where we take different number of crudes and so forth, without exception, are giving substantial higher profits than the swing cut and fixed yield. It's interesting to see that the swing cut actually does improve considerably over fixed yield. So it is an improvement in that sense. But nevertheless, the main point here, it's very clear that the fractionation index, the nonlinear model, can do, you know, in that sense, a lot better. Another interesting issue here is the following. So you would think we do a nonlinear model, we're going to pay a penalty versus doing a, quote, very efficient LP. Well, this is the first case, and you can see the size of the fixed yield swing cut is of the order of, you know, hundreds of variables or so in constraints. Fractionation index is one order of magnitude larger, so of the order of 1,000. But yet, if you look at the computing time, this is, for this case, 0.32 versus 0.14, 0.18. For all practical purposes, we're talking almost the same amount of CPU time. And the same applied, actually, for the case where we had three and four crudes. You can see, again, problems are an order of magnitude larger, but yet, you know, the computational times are, you know, still less than a second of CPU time. And here, by the way, the problems, you know, are roughly, you know, they do have a good number of linearities, but nevertheless, it's about 30% nonlinear variable. So the main message here is that I think, you know, this idea of trying to always avoid nonlinear problems, and given the developments that have taken place, you know, it's something that is really, in a way, unfounded. Now, so what about now solving large-scale problems? So here, there's not a single simple formula what to do. For example, one case, which I show here, strategy one, you may be able to pose a problem, let's say, as a traveling salesman problem, and then, of course, you can exploit that structure. And that's going to be usually much more effective than throwing a problem to a general-purpose solver. Another strategy is, as I alluded before, may have to be to do some type of decomposition because maybe the problem is simply too large. The other strategy, which is also, you know, often used, is the three, some type of heuristic, where we just simply realize maybe obtaining academic, let's say, optimality may be perhaps too much. It's maybe good enough at least to try to get some good feasible solutions as long as, you know, these can capture both trade-offs and maybe complex discrete choices. So let me illustrate here one case for decomposition. This is the design supply chain with stochastic inventory. The problem here, we have suppliers, these are factories, distribution centers that are to be determined, and some retailers, some markets, where we have uncertainties on the demand. So the major decisions here, in this case, the suppliers and the retailers are fixed. What we want to determine is how many distribution centers we should build and to what markets should they actually serve. So that's the structural problem. But there's also an inventory decision here, which is how often are we going to replenish the inventory, these distribution centers, what is the reorder point, order quantity, and especially what should be the safety stock. So those are basically the major decisions here. And the objective, as you can see, is basically minimizing cost of the distribution center, transportation, and the inventory-related costs like safety stock and working inventory. Now, this is a problem where essentially the trade-off is between transportation and inventory. So it turns out if I build a single distribution center, safety stock will be the smallest because you have the so-called risk pooling effect. On the other hand, if I build only one, cost of transportation is likely to be the largest. On the other hand, if I go to the other extreme and I have many distribution centers, then, you know, transportation will be less, but then I have to distribute the safety stock in the various inventory places. So in this work, which, by the way, was done by Feng Jiayu, who is now at Northwestern, this is the general form of the model. Don't want to go into great detail except to point out to the fact that this is, again, a nonlinear problem. It's an integer nonlinear problem. Interestingly enough, there's been in the literature, especially in OR, virtually only one or two papers that have addressed this problem. And why? Because, unfortunately, by and large, the culture in OR has always been to move away from nonlinear problems. So you don't want to touch them. If it's linear, it's fine, but if it's nonlinear, don't want to do that. Well, nevertheless, here you can see there are linear terms for installation, the part of the transportation, but the next two terms here for the economic order quantity and safety stocks, these are nonlinear in terms actually of the 0-1 variables. Now, here, the 0-1 variables, the x's would represent whether or not we build a distribution center, and the y is assigning whether distribution center j is serving a given market I. And that's why we have these simple assignment type of constraints here. Now, here again, it turns out, because this is a non-convex integer nonlinear programming problem, we cannot just simply say, well, give it to Baron, and Baron will take care of it, because now, at least the state of global optimization still does not allow to solve the large-scale problems. If it's a small problem, we might be able to do it. So here, we had to do some analysis and conclude that the y's could actually be treated as continuous. We reformulated the problem, so we did not have square roots involving expressions with binary variables, so we introduced a new variable, put it as a constraint, and basically at the end, we ended up solving the problem through Lagrangian decomposition. But the problem has few distribution centers and markets, Baron actually can solve that problem. But we were interested, as shown in the next slide here, to solve problems with up to 150 retailers, which means up to 150 distribution centers, which meant, you know, the order of 20,000 constraints and variables. And here, what I'm showing in the table is first four instances with up to 88 retailers, which again, same as distribution centers, and the last two with 150. And again, so the size of these problems is quite substantial. The parameters here, beta and theta, just simply represent relative cost of transportation and inventory. But I think the important point here, as you can see, the last column tells you computational time, so these range from 300, the most expensive one took 3,000 seconds, so less than an hour of computational time, and you can see the gaps are very small. Incidentally, the problems, because they're very small, we have like here in the case of 150 sub-problems, these are sold to global optimality, so we are making use actually of Baron, but because we are dealing with them at small dimensionality. On the other hand, if you try to solve this problem directly with Baron in full space, as you can see, well, first of all, it turns out in this case, out of the six cases, three Baron does not find the same solution. Interesting enough, in three, it does find the same solution, but the problem, it does not verify that that's the solution because the gap, as you can see in the last columns, is still fairly large in most cases, of the order of 10 to 20%. Whereas, in fact, the Lagrangian relaxation were of the order of 1% or even less. Okay, so again, that shows a case how, again, a tailored type of approach can make a difference. So we cannot expect here just simply to take some commercial software and solve the problem. Now, what about the multi-scale optimization challenge? So here, the issue is we have sort of two types of problems. One that are mostly temporal in nature, and that was, if you remember, the first slide when I talk about especially planning, scheduling, and control. And here I'm just listing a number of references because this is a problem that has received, you know, a fair number of attention. The other one is the one of spatial integration, where you deal with global type of problems, where you have geographically distributed sites. And again, here the absolute key is, again, decomposition, all right? And let me show you here one application. This was actually work with Sebastian Terrazas looking at multi-site planning and scheduling. So the idea here, each of these boxes would represent geographically a different site. Okay, it's like site one, site S, okay? And within each site, we have planning decisions that may be where we need to determine on a weekly basis how much to produce inventories, but we also need to implement, you know, detailed scheduling decisions almost on an hourly basis. So here, we go from weeks to hours, so we have the element, if you wish, of the temporal scale that we have to deal with. And then at the other end, we also have the spatial scale, right? Because we have to deal with multiple sites. And the question is, you know, how do you approach such a problem? So here, this is the picture that we want to deal with. So we have multiple sites, again, interacting with the market. So we need to decide what site produces what product and what market does it serve. And here again, in principle, we could do a single monolithic model, but because of the multi-scale issue, you know, we do need to really rely on some type of decomposition. So what we did here, the temporal part, we dealt with the bilevel decomposition that I outlined before, and the geographical type or spatial distribution with that, with Lagrangian decomposition. So this is an example of a hybrid type of scheme where we're combining actually both. And this is, next slide, this is just an example where in this case we have like three different sites. This is actually showing that site 2 is producing exclusively product A, site B is producing B, C, B, A, as you can see, or site 3, A and B. And the picture below just simply shows what products are being produced and what markets are being served. Now, again, if this is a problem at this level, we can easily solve it directly without any decomposition. But if you want to solve a larger problem, and this is the next slide here, 33, where we're showing the CPU time versus the number of discrete variables. So you can see on the left the problem I presented, the three sites, two markets, three products, 4 weeks, you know, it gets solved, you know, very fast. So it's not an issue. But if you go towards the right, for example, here to a problem that has something like six sites, 25 products, 12 weeks, if you do the monolithic simultaneous, this is the dashed line, you're talking, you know, of a tremendous increase in terms of computation. The lowest line here is the one of the hybrid, so that means that's the most effective type of scheme. The one in the middle is the one where we're doing only the bilevel decomposition. We're not combining it with another one. So again, this again just simply comes to show, and this is, by the way, one of the reasons why you usually don't find packages where decomposition is already established, because often, again, you do need to tailor it to your own application. Now, another good example of multi-scale optimization is this problem of electric power optimization, a project we've been doing with Praxair through Summit and Interact, especially with Jose Pinto. Idea here is you're given an air separation plant, and if you look at the process, of course, what you're doing here is producing a number of different products, liquid oxygen, nitrogen, argon, and also some gas products. But in terms of the process, clearly what dominates is the compressor. So here you have the electricity cost, which is basically the dominant cost, and you're facing a situation as shown in the graph on the left where the prices of electricity are changing very much, going from peaked prices to low prices and maybe changing during the hours. And the question is, can you take advantage somehow when you operate this type of plant so that you can maybe operate at high capacity if the price goes low, or reduce the capacity if the price goes up? So essentially then here we're dealing with operational decisions like what units we should operate at each point in time, what inventory levels, and then also if you want to take a sort of a design type of problem and deal with strategic decisions, you're designing type of system. It could be a retrofit, deciding do you add the additional liquefiers, do you upgrade the equipment, and so forth. So that's where the multi-scale nature sort of comes in. And this, again, can be seen in this slide here. So the way we've approached it, you see, conceptually a problem here, we're showing just simply here, starting at year one for the first year. And we need to keep track of the operation on an hourly basis. And by the way, this is a problem. Just came back from a meeting in London on computational management science, and it seemed to me really interesting how almost everybody was grappling with this issue. Long-term decisions with decisions on an hourly basis, because that's where, you know, pricing of electricity changes. So here what we do, we divide the year into basically season, and each season is then characterized by a week. And doing it that way, the advantage that we have is that, for example, instead of dealing with 8,700 hours per year, we're dealing with 600. It's still a fairly large number of intervals, but at least it's been reduced by 10, because we assume that each of these weeks is repeated in a cyclic manner. Since we're dealing with discrete equipment sizes, it turns out this problem, and also using a simplified representation of the operating region, you can actually formulate it as a mixed integer linear program. The example we took here, just a proof of concept, was the idea of saying, well, Let's assume you have the choice of either upgrading the equipment or maybe buying additional equipment that would be operating in parallel here in the air separation unit. Then, furthermore, let's assume that we also consider a possibility of buying additional tanks so that we have more inventory so that we can then reduce the production whenever that's needed. And we did this over 1 year with four periods, and it turns out the optimal solution that we obtained indicated that it actually paid to buy new equipment in the first time period, not doing upgrading, and actually not including any of these storage tanks. So the answer in that sense is relatively simple, but you can see even such a simple answer comes from a fairly large model. Here we have 18,001 variables, about a quarter million constraints, and again, why is that? This 1 year, because we need to keep track of what happens essentially on an hourly basis. And this, by the way, using deterministic forecasts of the prices. You can see here, in this case, Cplex, it takes almost 5 hours to get a relatively small gap. In this case, we applied the bilevel decomposition. And in this case, as you can see, we can solve the problem in just over 1 hour. And again, this is one further example on how to deal with these multi-scale type of problems where you do absolutely require to do some type of decomposition. Okay, so let me then finish here with the uncertainty challenge. And I think, as I mentioned before, the two major paradigms here are short-term robust optimization, and I would say this tends to be more suitable for short-term type of problems, because in robust optimization, there's usually, at least in the most common case, no idea of recourse. To implement something, it has to be good, has to be feasible for some time. The stochastic programming, conceptually, is usually better for problems that are long-term, especially strategic type of problems, because of the recourse. The big difference, though, here, and that's why there's been a lot of temptation often to say, well, let's do robust optimization, because those problems often can be solved in about the same time as the deterministic model, or sometimes a little bit more, but comparable. Stochastic programming, the big penalty that you pay, you're talking about at least, at the very least, one or two orders of magnitude larger. Okay, so it's a big step. Again, at that meeting, it was interesting because one of the speakers, Wallace, which is sort of a major player in the area, was kind of frustrated why industry was not interested in solving stochastic programming problems. Well, I think part of it, again, has to do with the fact these are still not easy problems to solve. Now, so let me see. So what can we do here? Well, I want to show you first this example, a global sourcing project that we did with Dow Chemical. This was an internship that Fengji had at Dow. And it was a fairly large problem, global problem, 100 facilities, 1,000 customers, and so forth. And the idea then here was, given inventories, transportation times, there was uncertainty in the demands and production reliability. We had to determine inventory levels, transportation, sale amounts, and our objective was to minimize costs. Now, the big issue here, when you have such a large problem, you have a large number of uncertain demands, and the problem here actually boiled down to a two-stage programming problem, because the idea was to make a decision, say, for the first month, and then leave the recourse for the subsequent decisions. The number of scenarios that arises with discrete demands, if you take high, medium, and low, is billions. It's literally billions. So here, what we had to do was to use a technique based on Monte Carlo sampling to reduce it to 1,000 scenarios. But even so, we're talking about already solving a simplified version of the problem. Okay, so here what happens? Well, this is the deterministic model. If there was no uncertainties, you can see still fairly large problem, 60, 80,000 variables. If you take the 1,000 scenarios, if you wanted to solve it in one single shot, you would have to deal with 50 million constraints, 70 million continuous variables. And obviously the main point here, you cannot solve this directly. It would take, if you apply Binder's decomposition, which you can do here, it takes about 5 days to solve that problem, okay? There is an improved version of Binder's, the so-called multi-cut. You can bring it down to 5 hours. And in fact, in this case, if we had access to something like, say, 50 parallel computers, we could even solve it in half hour. But again, it just, again, comes to show that, these problems are expensive to solve. And the question here is it really worth it? And so here the interesting thing, this was the idea that really came from John Wasik, was the idea of comparing a stochastic planner versus a deterministic planner. So in this plot, this is cost versus, you know, this is simulation over many time periods. The curve in red essentially comes from solution of somebody who has access to the stochastic programming model. The one in blue is somebody who has access to only a deterministic model and has implemented the solution. And the main conclusion, main result that came out from here is that the decision maker that was using the stochastic model could, on average, realize savings of the order of 5.7%. Now, 5.7 may not sound very large, but again, keep in mind this is a global type of operation, so the amount involved is very large. Now, another case of uncertainty is this project that we had with ExxonMobil. This was with Borat Tarhan, where we had the reservoir with potential locations of wells. And the major decisions here have to do with the infrastructure. Could be the so-called tension leg platform or the so-called FPSOs, the floating production storage offshore, where you do drill the subsea wells. The main point here is you need to decide, you know, which ones of these are you going to build, which wells are you going to drill. And this, given the fact that you have uncertainty in the productivity, in the size of the reservoir, and also production of water. So in this case, it turns out another big challenge is that the reservoir model, strictly speaking, is, you know, a very complex model. So what we're doing here, we're generating these approximations that come from very detailed simulations that tell us, you know, what is the initial production of oil and how it gets depleted with time until you reach a point where you do not extract oil anymore. And that then dictates the size of the reservoir. And again, uncertainty here with it with discrete distributions. And essentially, the challenge here is what I mentioned before. These are endogenous uncertainties. And what does that mean? It means that the tree, decision tree, will depend, or scenario tree depends on the decision. So, for example, if you invest in a field in year one, okay, you invest it, you find out then whether the size is large, high, medium, or low, but in subsequent time periods, basically nothing happens because supposedly the uncertainty got revealed. On the other hand, if you postpone the investment until year five, nothing happens at the beginning, then it's realized here. Now, if you have now combinations of fields, then you can start to see this start to become somewhat more complicated. So it's complicated because of those decisions. So here, sort of the generic form of the problem is, again, we maximize the expected net present value, which is a weighted probability. The main source of nonlinearity here is related to reservoir performance, so here we cannot avoid, again, the nonlinearity. And what really complicates the problem is the so-called non-anticipativity constraints. These are disjunctions or conditional constraints that tell us whether or not the tree has a given form. And I don't have time to go into detail except to mention the reason the complication is because you have to do it for every pair of scenarios and at every time period. So the size just simply explodes, and that means you cannot just simply reformulate it as a single monolithic MNLP. You do have to rely again on decomposition. In this case, we did Lagrangian relaxation and branch and bound. This is an example of a result that came out of a problem with a single reservoir over 10 years and with 8 scenarios. Okay, and this is just to give you a flavor of what kind of answer you get. Expected net present value of the order of 5 billion. And this is really the answer that you want to get from the model. What should I do in year one? So here it tells, well, build 2 small FPSOs and drill 12 wells. But the important thing is that this type of model, being multi-stage, is also anticipating the following fact. That, for example, in year two, if here on the left it turns out the size is small, productivity is small, we just keep it the way it is. We keep drilling those 12 wells. At the other extreme, if the outcome is positive, we have larger size, larger productivity, we actually build 5 additional ESOs, 3 LPs, and, you know, we start then also drilling more wells. And this basically then gets reflected through this type of tree structure, where basically, in a way, we're simulating in the future what the different outcomes could be and what actions we're going to take. But at the end, remember, we're only interested in the solution of year one. So obviously this model is applied only, sort of in the receding horizon. And here again, is it worth to go into so much trouble? So here we're showing for the 8 different scenarios, which are combinations again of the discrete distributions, the solution in red. This comes if you do mean value and then apply the simulation, then you get an MPB of 4.38. The multi-stage stochastic programming here is predicting a 12% increase. Obviously, we're getting a better economic answer. But more than that, what's also interesting here, you look at the red bars, you can see the first two are actually negative. So it means there are scenarios here where we actually end up losing money if we rely on the expected value. That does not happen with the blue bars in stochastic programming, where in all cases we get positive net present value. So there's also an inherent robustness that we're gaining. Okay? Now, these problems are not cheap to solve. The initial version of the algorithm took 120 hours. In the later version where we improved it, we could bring it down to something like 5 hours. So here again, just to make that point, you constantly have to fight this issue. And here, let me just finish with the multi-objective approach. This is a problem that we looked at on design of the supply chain polystyrene. Here's a map of the U.S., and in green, these are possible plant sites, and I'll show you in a moment what the technologies are. Then we have suppliers in blue, the reds are the markets, and we have also distribution centers. So here, the main point is we have a dedicated process where ethylene and benzene produce styrene, and then 2 multi-product plants producing, 3 grades of solid polystyrene or 2 grades of expandable polystyrene. This is sort of the equivalent of the superstructure, the network that has to be modeled. And a big issue here is characterizing the responsiveness. What I'm showing here from the supply to the distribution center, this is production lead time. And if you have the inventory here, then you deliver it to the customer, and that's the delivery lead time. So if you assume that you have uncertainty in the demand that is shown here, then if you pick some given level of stockout probability, like the area in red, you can come up with an expression of what is the expected lead time. It's the LD, which is the delivery lead time, plus the production lead time times probability of stockout. So if probability of stockout is 0, all right, why? Because I have enough inventory, then the lead time reduces only to the 1 of the delivery. On the other hand, if probability of stockout is 1, because I don't have enough inventory, I may have to always do both times, okay? And then, of course, anything in between. So here again, this is the form of the model. It's a bi-criterion, multi-period MINLP with the corresponding constraints. Nonlinearities come out especially from scheduling, the probabilistic constraints. And this is the main result that you get. This is now the Pareto surface. This was generated with epsilon constraint. It shows that, obviously, the highest MPV is achieved here, close to 700, but then with an expected lead time close to 5 days. If you really want to be responsive and do it in day and a half, you can do that, but then at a considerably decrease of the MPV. The curve in red would be the one where there's actually no safety stock. So here, the more you go to the left, the more responsive you are. Now here, these curves are useful because here, for example, we can see with relatively small decrease, we can go from 5 to 3.5 days. So that would seem to be a good choice. And again, in principle, it could be any. The other useful information that you get here is the safety stock versus the expected lead time. So you can see if you really want to be responsive, you carry an enormous amount of inventory. The suggested 3.5 days is only about 1/10 of that. So that's, again, just one example, again, how multi-objective optimization could also be of use. Okay? Now, I know I'm running out of time, but let me just mention here this other issues, future directions. At the meeting of FOCAPO, there was a lot of discussion integrating control with planning and scheduling. And here I would say the main challenge is still, the mixed integer dynamic optimization. If we don't have such a tool, it's really difficult to accomplish that objective, and that seems to be a major challenge. Optimizing entire supply chains. I mean, we can do that to some extent, but still, especially, for example, in the petroleum type of application, combining maritime with vehicle transportation, pipelines, and so forth, is still, you know, a major challenge, or adding financial models. Or then, of course, also this increased interest in energy, you know, type of supply chain, sustainable supply chains. Again, how you model the complexity of those problems. Chris Flores, for example, gave a nice presentation on that topic at the meeting. So main point here is, again, just simply to convey the message. There's still a lot of important problems and challenges that need to be addressed. These are some examples. And again, just to finish off here, I think, there's no question that this area is of industrial interest, and I think it's also shown, to a large extent, its value, that the key components are definitely planning and scheduling, and especially the multi-scale modeling part is definitely still a major issue, especially at the temporal stage. And then finally, that in terms of computation, again, you have to contend with large-scale models and, for example, handling uncertainty, especially if you choose with stochastic programming, is still an absolutely non-trivial exercise. Okay? Again, this is just to convey that, fortunately, there's still a lot of work ahead to do in the area. Okay? So with this, I'd like to thank your attention, and I realize I'm just 1 minute before the hour, so thank you very much. Okay? Thank you. So, I don't know if there are any questions or any comments. I don't know, is there still anybody out there in the audience who would like to ask something? Maybe they're all left. Yeah. So, any questions out there? I think there's no questions. What about here? Any quick questions? Or? No comment? Yeah, okay. Yeah. No, technically what you do is you pick a level of confidence. So, for example, there we picked, I think, like 95% confidence level. And then you can predict how many scenarios do you need to get a 95% confidence level. If we wanted like 99% confidence level, then probably that would go up to, say, 10,000 scenarios. If I take a lower level of confidence, 90%, maybe it's only 50 scenarios. So there's some techniques for doing that. Yeah.
Is there an economic incentive for doing, say, stochastic programming? For example, what if you just implemented a deterministic solution and decided to pay penalties for finding the constraints? Would that be an economically better option than actually doing a conservative solution from stochastic programming?
Yeah. Yeah, well, again, the question here, is it really worth to go through the trouble of stochastic programming? Why not maybe use deterministic and be willing, if needed, to pay the penalty? Well, the reason I would say, first of all, it depends, again, on the application, okay? The example of the oil field, those investments are huge. I mean, you're talking about billions of dollars. If you got it wrong, you could actually, not only lose a lot of money, maybe the whole company may go bust, and there's been actually some cases like that where smaller companies like drilled in the Gulf Oil made the wrong decision and, they just went out of business. So anticipating uncertainty there is very important. But also I want to clarify, because you mentioned that the conservative solution you get from uncertainty, that's actually not quite right. Conservative solutions only come from robust optimization, because in robust, what I'm saying is like saying, given any input, I want to make sure I'm always feasible. A good example, I want this building to withstand earthquakes up to 7.5 Richter, okay? So we're going to be conservative. We're not going to fool around and build a building that, may withstand less and then it falls down. So being conservative there is extremely important. But being conservative, for example, in the oil field problem might also not be a good idea, because I may say, let's start building platforms all over the place. So I'm sure, you know, that supposedly I can meet all my constraints, but then that's going to translate into huge investment. And then doing the deterministic, you see, the problem with deterministic is you're optimizing only for a given condition. And if you deviate from that condition, then, so you see, one of the benefits that people often don't quite realize about stochastic programming, you're subjecting the system to many scenarios. So even if the distribution functions are not perfect, just the mere fact that you're kind of simulating different type of events under which the system has to operate inherently introduces more robustness in the sense of being less sensitive, if you wish, to changes in, for example, in the cost. All right. Okay, well, with this, I have to go actually to the faculty meeting. I'm already late, so thank you, and see you then. Bye-bye.